chair.
We're just discussing briefly, Judge Riley's chair seems to be a little broken, so if she looks shorter, it's not that.
Uncooperative. I'm good.
Are you sure? Okay. All right, and then I'll invite counsel for our next case to come forward and settle yourselves at counsel table. We'll just continue making our record in this case, and which, you know, as everyone knows, these proceedings are being recorded. So I'll ask the marshal to call the second case.
Case 8-18-1761, State of Minnesota, Appellant versus Minnesota School of Business Incorporated, doing business as Minnesota School of Business at all. Respondents.
And I'll talk just briefly, in part to give you some time. Please take it, settle in, get whatever you need to be comfortable for the argument and the proceedings today. The matter's been called, and I just want to make just a few comments. I know that you're very familiar with our court and the proceedings that are conducted here. I will remind you, as I did counsel for the previous argument, please take your time to settle in and have what you need to begin the conversation with the court. I invite you to make any adjustments to the podium that will make it easier for us to hear you and for you to speak to us. And then just remind you what you probably already know. We want you, for our oral record, to identify yourselves for the record, as well as the client that you represent. So it looks like counsel for appellant is ready to go. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Alan Gilbert. I'm a member of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I represent the state in this matter. This is a very important case for the state of Minnesota. It not only involves the appropriate remedial relief for 6,000 students who are issued illegal loans by respondents, but it also implicates the Attorney General's authority to enforce Minnesota's consumer protection laws on behalf of the public. There's essentially four questions before the court today. The first one is, did respondents' violation of the Chapter 56 licensure requirement apply to all of the loans that respondents issued to the 6,000 students? The second issue is, are the students entitled to the return of all the money they paid on the illegal loans? The third question is...
meaning both principal and interest.
Yes, Your Honor. And then the third question is the Attorney General authorized to obtain monetary relief for the students, as well as civil penalties and the state's costs and attorney's fees? And then the last question is, should the students' monetary relief include prejudgment interest?
I just need to back up so I understand factually how the loans worked. As I understand it, it sounds like they were self-funded by the school. Is that right?
Well, the school dispersed a credit to the students periodically,
so
yes.
So the school had a pot of money available to loan to the students?
No. They just dispersed it in the form of a credit because the schools were providing the educational services. So they didn't actually provide them money, but they provided them a credit, which was subject to a promissory note or a retail installment contract that provided for the terms of repayment by the students.
Okay. And so when you talk about the illegal loans, you're talking about all of them or the ones that were over 8%?
I'm talking about all of them are illegal because the school violated the Chapter 56 licensure requirement as to all of the loans. And the reason for that is, I think, pretty straightforward based on the Supreme Court's opinion in this very case. The Supreme Court, as a result, has already decided the first question, and that is, by ruling that under either party's interpretation of Section 5601A, that respondents were required to obtain a license under 5601. So in other words, the Supreme Court said under either interpretation, they needed a license. And the state's interpretation of the licensure requirement clearly applies to all the loans, as the Supreme Court acknowledged. Again, the state's position is that they needed a license, because they're engaged in the business making loans. As a result, they need a license for all of the loans. The respondents have conceded that they are engaged in the business of making loans. So in light of the Supreme Court's ruling that under either party's interpretation they needed a license, it's clear that based on the state's interpretation, they needed a license, literally. If respondents disagreed with what the Supreme Court said, they should have asked for reconsideration under Rule 140. They didn't do it. As a result, the Supreme Court's ruling is the law of the case. And as a result, the ruling applies to all of the loans as it relates to the Chapter 56 licensure requirement. We have also briefed up the merits of this issue in the alternative, but in light of what the Supreme Court decided, and in particular, the Supreme Court said it is not necessary to decide the merits of the issue. We don't think the court needs to resolve that on the merits, but we briefed up the issue nonetheless, and we think very clearly the proper interpretation of the statute would require licensure of the respondents based on the fact that they were engaged in the business of making loans. The second issue deals with, well, what's the remedy for the students under Chapter 56? And the particular statutory provision, as I'm sure you're aware of, is Section 56.19, Subdivision 3. And that provision mandates that if there are unlicensed loans, that those loans are void as a matter of law by statute, and the students are entitled to a return of all the money they paid on the loans.
Well, just a minute. That gets back to Judge Riley's question. That isn't what the statute says. The statute says the debtor may recover from such persons all amounts paid. Is the advance of money on the books to go toward educational expenses that would otherwise be owed to the lender an amount that has been paid?
Yes, Your Honor, the point of the statute is it's all amounts paid by the students. Over time, the students have paid actual cash on those loans. And that's the only money we're asking for.
But the principal amount, maybe I'm misunderstanding the record. If I understand correctly, the student comes in, they're at the point in the process, as described in the briefing, where they're presented with this option. They're going to owe more money to the schools. And instead of going out and borrowing the money from a different lender and paying it to the schools, the schools issue a loan that serves as a credit on those educational costs, right?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. But
so is that principal amount, that credit that is given to the student's account with the schools, is that an amount paid?
To the extent that the students have paid, made payments on those loans, they include both interest and principal. So it's actual cash that they have paid the schools over time.
Okay.
Okay? And that's so, what the
so
statute says.
So your intention then is under Rule 56, anything that has not been paid is void.
It's void. You can't collect it.
Anything that has been paid, principal and interest, should go back.
And that's precisely what the statute says.
Thank you.
Then I have another question, because some of the loans were rewritten.
Yes.
And I couldn't find that the district court made findings that the loans that had the greater than 8% interest rate were then rolled into new loans at or below 8%.
The court didn't deal with that, Your Honor, but again, if you accept the proposition that all of the loans were subject to licensure and the 56.19 remedy is what it says it is.
Well, I understand that's your argument, that the district court didn't find it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm trying to figure out is when the district court took those loans that were rewritten into account, did she calculate that in the interest owed, or can't we tell from the arithmetic?
I think we can tell that to the extent principal or interest was paid on any loan of more than 8%, mm-hmm. that she did provide for that. So as to the interest, she gave a judgment of $3.7 million. Mm-hmm. But as you know, she didn't provide for the refunding of the principal payments made by the students.
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
So, counsel, let me follow up, because I understand you're relying on 56.19, and I may not understand it well, and I'd appreciate hearing your thoughts. So this is a statute that says the debtor may recover from such persons all amounts paid, and then you've already explained in response to other questions that this, in the case of this credit scenario, this is when the student does make payments on the principal and interest, and I assume there's some calculation out there exactly what that is. Now, some of those students made payments, but they also received an education. And it seems that that was the sticking point for the district court, at least that's how I read the district court's comments. It felt as though, well, that student did receive something for that that principal payment, certainly, you know, whatever, we if we want to set the interest mm-hmm. aside, but for the principal, the student received something, so why would that inequity, why would that student receive the principal payment back after they've received the education?
Thank you, Your Honor. And there's multiple answers to that, Your Honor. But the first one is that even in equity, a court has to apply the plain language of a statute. And that's why we are referring to 56.19 in the first instance.
Well, that's what I'm asking. So the statute says the debtor may recover,
yeah.
Which certainly means that, I think, means we'll hear what Respondent's Counsel says, but I think means the debtor may seek it. And you're obviously standing in the shoes of the debtor and seeking it. But does that necessarily mean a district court has to award it? There are many remedies laid out in our statutes that mean that a plaintiff can seek something. It doesn't necessarily mean that they will receive it once the proceedings have concluded.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. And the statute doesn't say that they may seek it. It says may recover those damages.
But it also doesn't say shall recover.
It doesn't. But again,
the district court seemed to rely on.
Yes. Well, not really. The district court didn't. The other side is relying on it. The district court actually said that the plain language of the statute requires that kind of payment. What the district court said is that the Attorney General's office doesn't have the authority to recover the money on behalf of the students. And again, we cited to the Sunday case, Your Honor, which is written by Judge Kischel in bankruptcy court. Very well-reasoned decision, and he makes the observation, which I think is very clear, that even though the word may is used, it isn't discretionary. The reason for the word may is because someone first has to bring the case. Once they bring the case under the statute, they are entitled as a matter of law to that remedy.
Are you now analyzing the 8.31?
No, I'm analyzing 56.19, but I can move on to 8.31.
If I can ask you one more question about 56.19, because your interpretation of that statute, if we were to adopt it, mm-hmm. Would have some pretty big implications in other areas other than the student loan scenario, right? Because this is a general statute about remedies available for usurious loans and unlicensed loans, right?
I think it would, Your Honor, because, again, if you look at the statute in context, what it's saying is you may recover. The may, all that designates or denotes is that you may recover it if you actually bring a lawsuit.
Right, but would there be a scenario, say, where this illegal loan is used to purchase a good, so, for instance, a house or a piece of property, right? And then the proceedings went forward, probably not by the Attorney General's office, but by a private party, but under the same statute where they may recover. Would they then still get the principal back?
Your Honor, under the law, under the common law, there are numerous cases that say no, that a debtor can get the principal back without giving back the property. That's because it's an illegal activity. Okay. And we've cited two numerous cases for that proposition. That really is undisputed, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of your case law.
And those statutes are interpreting 56.19.
They are not interpreting 56.19, but they're interpreting the usury statute to the extent the usury statute provided for the voidance of a loan based upon the lender charging a usurious rate. And I think that's very clear. And then in other contexts as well, even the district court in this case recognized that principle, that if you have a void loan, that doesn't mean that if a void loan, which necessarily means that the debtor can get the money back, both principal and interest, that doesn't mean that the debtor has to return anything. And the case law is clear on that, Your Honor. We've cited to numerous cases for that proposition. You know, why don't I move on to Section 8.31?
That's a similar analysis of what debtors, what someone may do.
The difference is, I understand what you're saying, but the difference is that 8.31 allows the Attorney General to seek monetary relief under 56.19. And it is a little different analysis because it's relying upon the language of 8.31 for the proposition that the Attorney General can actually sue, in this case, to get monetary relief for the students. And we've gone through great length explaining how that statute works. And frankly, the district court's analysis doesn't really make any sense in terms of what she decided. Subdivision 1 very clearly says that any laws that are referred to in Subdivision 1 can be enforced by the Attorney General. The Minnesota Supreme Court in this very case has already determined that Chapter 56 is one of those laws that's referred to in Subdivision 1. And we cited to the Supreme Court opinion for that proposition. Subdivision 2 actually reiterates the fact that laws that are specifically cited in Subdivision 1 and those that are more generally referred to are covered by Subdivision 1. And then Subdivision 3, like Subdivision 2, says the same thing. It says laws referred to both specifically and generally are covered by Subdivision 1. And then Subdivision 3A provides for the Attorney General to be able to enforce all the remedies provided in Subdivision 3A, which include damages, which includes other remedies provided by law, which in this case would be 56.19. So again, tying those two statutes together, 56.19 provides what the remedy is in terms of full repayment of principal and interest paid by the students on the illegal loans. 8.31 allows the Attorney General to seek that remedy from a court. And that remedy, again, is a remedy that, as a matter of law, must be applied. And then I see my light is blinking. Could I take a minute to talk about, or do you want me to do this on rebuttal, on prejudgment interest?
You know, at this point, I'll ask you to just proceed for 1 minute on prejudgment interest, and then we'll add a minute to the time for respondent as well. So go ahead, Mr. Miller.
And, Your Honor, I know you just issued an opinion on prejudgment interest, and it's a statutory provision. In the first instance, we're relying on the common law, and the common law is very clear that we can get prejudgment interest in the case of this kind. In fact, this is a classic case where prejudgment interest is appropriate, where the loss here is quantifiable based upon the damages, and the damages are the payments made by the students. And that number has already been determined, has been calculated, and as a result, you can apply the 6% interest rate for prejudgment interest on those monies as to each payment that the students have made. So with that, Your Honor, I'll wait for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel, Brooke Anthony on behalf of respondents, Minnesota School of Business and Globe University. This was a parents' patriot case. There is no express authority for the Attorney General to enforce the remedies of Chapter 56 or 334. In that circumstance, the Attorney General can still obtain monetary remedies, but it must do so parents' patriot, pursuant to the court's equitable authority. That's what the state did here, and that's what the district court awarded. The district court properly exercised its discretion in awarding equitable restitution in the form of interest paid on loans issued in excess of 8%.
How do you respond to Mr. Gilbert's argument that in light of the Supreme Court's decision concerning the requirement of the schools to have obtained a Chapter 56 license in an action brought by the Attorney General, that seems to suggest that the Attorney General can bring such an action?
Your Honor, Section 8.31 does vest the Attorney General with certain abilities pursuant to 8.31 on laws that are unfair, discriminatory, or unlawful practices in business, commerce, or trade. And we can jump right to 8.31 right now. 8.31, as the court is aware, outlines the specific authority that the Attorney General has to enforce and prosecute states and statutes in the state of Minnesota. Subdivision 1 of that section specifically outlines, it specifically enumerates certain laws, and then it generally describes other laws as unfair, discriminatory, unlawful practices. Chapter 50.
Using the language specifically, but not exclusively.
Yes. Chapter 56 is not specifically enumerated in Subdivision 1, but it does fall into the general description of unlawful practices in the areas of business, commerce, or trade. The legislature in Section 8.31 used two different categories in describing the statutes in Subdivision 1. One category is actually in Subdivision 3 of Section 8.31, where the legislature says that for those statutes, for those laws referred to in Subdivision 1 specifically and generally, the Attorney General has authority to pursue an injunction for those statutes. That is the broader description that the legislature uses in 8.31. Elsewhere in the statute, the legislature uses a more narrow description of the laws in Subdivision 1 with the language referred to in Subdivision 1, meaning the laws specifically referred to in Subdivision 1. And the legislature is very clear that the Attorney General's authority is different with respect to the broader category of of statutes and the more narrow category of statutes. So here, what the district court found and what the Supreme Court was addressing in the Supreme Court's opinion, Your Honor, is the state's authority to pursue an injunction. And if Your Honor looks at the specific pages of the Supreme Court opinion that discuss the state's authority to pursue remedies pursuant to 8.31, the Supreme Court is discussing specifically in the injunction. And that is from Subdivision 3, which provides that the state can pursue an injunction for those statutes referred to in Subdivision 1 specifically and generally. But for the remedies that the state is seeking here, the monetary remedies, the attorney's fees, and the civil penalties, those remedies are limited only to the narrow category of laws specifically referred to in Subdivision 1. And we know that the language laws referred to in Subdivision 1 is narrow because if that language was meant to mean the same thing as the broader description, there would be no need for the language specifically and generally in the statute. The legislature was intentionally creating two different categories under which the Attorney General has authority. And I also want to touch on just briefly the Supreme Court, the state's argument that the Supreme Court decided this issue. The Supreme Court did not decide the scope of the licensing requirement and did not decide the remedies that were appropriate as a result of the school's failure to be licensed. If when this court reads the Supreme Court opinion, which I'm sure the court has, primary issue in that appeal was whether the loans issued at greater than 8% were open-end credit plans. And because they were not, because the loans greater than 8% were not open-end credit plans, the schools were required to be licensed for those loans. There was no concession in oral argument that the licensing requirement applied to all the loans. If Your Honors listen to the transcript of that argument, it is clear that the justices and counsel are referring to the loans over 8%. There is no concession, not even a mention, that the licensing requirement would apply to loans at any interest rate, regardless of what that interest rate is. And so when the Supreme Court entered its decision, it issued a general remand back to the district court, saying to the district court, conduct further proceedings consistent with this opinion. And that is what the district court did. The courts in the state courts in Minnesota have found that where the district court or the Supreme Court issues a general remand, the district court has discretion to do what is necessary to comply with that remand. And the district court here determined that in order to comply with that remand and determine the appropriate remedy under Chapter 56, the district court needed to have a trial. And that's what the district court did to ensure that it had a full and complete record on which to determine the state's remedies. When the district court did that, it did two things. It entered an injunction consistent with Subdivision 3 of Section 8.31. The practical effect of that injunction was to void and render uncollectible over $18 million in principal. The second thing
those are loans which, after 2009, had an interest rate of greater than 8%.
Yes. And that distinction, Your Honor.
Which, by the way, to get back to a question that was asked of Mr. Gilbert, that amount, as I understand it now, includes loans that had once had an interest rate of over 8% but have since been rewritten to include loans that have to have an interest rate of under 8%.
There were no findings in the district court that that had actually happened, so I'm not sure that is true. I know that counsel for the state says that repeatedly, but that is not what the district court found, and that is not what the evidence
supported. So you don't think we know the answer to that
question? We do not know the answer to that. In fact, that was not the testimony that the schools gave at trial, and the court did not make findings one way or the other.
Thank you.
Going back to Chapter 56, because I want to talk about this distinction with respect to loans greater than 8%. Chapter 56 does not say that any lender in the business of making loans must be licensed for all loans at all interest rates. That is not what the plain language of the statute says. The statute says that except as authorized by this chapter and without first obtaining a license, no person shall engage in the business of making loans of money, credit, or goods, or things in action, and charge, contract for, or receive on the loan a greater rate of interest that would be than the lender would be permitted by law to charge if not a licensee under this statute. The important language in that section begins with the word and continues to the end of the section. And charge, contract for, or receive on the loan a greater rate of interest than the lender would be permitted to charge if not a licensee. That language does two important things. It acknowledges that there are rates that are permissible for individuals, for lenders who are not licensees, and it advises a lender in the business of making loans, if you want to make a loan greater than the rate otherwise permitted for a non-licensee, you must have a license, and then you are required to comply with Chapter 56. So the except as authorized by this chapter language refers to those rates elsewhere identified in the chapter, which the lender would still be required to comply with even if the lender were a licensee. It also refers to those lenders that might otherwise be exempt from the licensing requirement, which is also part of the statute in 56. So it was consistent with the statutory language in Chapter 56 for the court to limit the remedy to only those loans for which the schools needed to be licensed. There was no if the schools never made a loan over the rate otherwise permitted by law, there would be no need to be licensed and no reason to award a remedy on those loans. And the district court properly made that limitation. The district court then turned to Chapter 56.19, which is the exclusive remedies provision of Chapter 56. Under 56.19, and Your Honors had this language correct, it is an exclusive remedies provision. Subdivision 3 deals with unlicensed lenders. And as Your Honors pointed out, no action may be brought, the debtor may recover from all persons all amounts paid. The most important word in that sentence is the word may. It is not a shall. It is a permissive word. The court in In re Sundi, that is a bankruptcy court, the court in In re Sundi found the word may to be mandatory, and importantly, the Supreme Court of Minnesota in Barton versus Moore has specifically rejected the reasoning of Judge Kischel in In re Sundi. Now, it was with respect to another statute, but what the Supreme Court found was that it does not follow the reasoning of bankruptcy courts in interpreting its statutes, and instead, the Supreme Court and the state courts in Minnesota follow our statutes dealing with legislative interpretation. And when the Supreme Court rejected the In re Sundi court reasoning, it did so because Judge Kischel did not follow the statutes for legislative interpretation, most particularly 645.44 and 645.16. 645.44 defines the word may as permissive. And so the state's interpretation of Subdivision 3 here is not consistent with the Minnesota statutes for legislative interpretation. Because the district court determined there was no statutory authority for the state to pursue monetary remedies here, the district court evaluated the equities and weighed them and determined an equitable restitution amount. The state does not dispute the district court's determination of the equities here or any of the district court's factual findings, which are detailed.
So let me go back to your statutory interpretation argument on 56.19. If I understand appellant's argument correctly, they are saying that your interpretation adds words to the statute because it's saying the debtor may seek to recover from such persons all amounts paid as opposed to the debtor may recover. So what's your response?
If I understand the state's position correctly that it does say may seek, then the state is the one adding words to the statute. The statute itself specifically says the debtor may recover, not the debtor may seek.
Yeah, I understand that. But aren't you saying that the statute gives permission to the court to make this decision? Because that's what happened.
Yes.
Here, isn't it?
So, yeah. So to the extent the debtor were to bring the claim.
Not
the court,
mandatory.
Yeah. To the extent the debtor were to bring a claim, the court would have the ability to decide whether it was appropriate to award all the interest in the principal or just the interest, as the court did here. And the district court specifically also looked at subdivision 4, which I think is an important subdivision in 56.19 as well, which not only provides that the remedies in this section are exclusive, but specifically acknowledges that a violation of this statute shall not impair the rights on the debt. And there is a distinction here between the loan and the debt. The debt here is the tuition that was to be paid for the education, which the court specifically found had value and which the state has not contested on appeal. So the district court determined in its factual findings that the education had value and the students had paid for that value in the form of tuition, which was the principal on the loan. So while the court did void collection on the rest of the principal on the loan, which was a $18.2 million impact, to go back and require repayment on something that there was no unlawful conduct in connection with the tuition would have impaired the rights on the school's rights on that debt. And so what the court did was determined in this case, it was not appropriate to award all the interest in the principal to the students who had loans over 8%. And it did so by weighing the equities, but that determination is consistent with the language in the statute. And so there was no abuse of discretion in making that determination. I want to touch on prejudgment interest. Prejudgment interest is not one of the exclusive remedies in 56.19. It is also not appropriate to award prejudgment interest on the basis that it was a readily ascertainable damages amount. No one had ascertained what the damages amount was until August of 2018.
When the district court found the damages.
Yes, but even then it was not readily ascertainable prior to that because two courts had determined that there were no damages. And then we still didn't know whether the student was entitled to all interest in principal or just interest until the court determined it in August.
I'm puzzled by that argument. Prejudgment interest is routinely awarded in cases where there's a judgment for personal injury. And until the jury returns its verdict, there's no ascertainment of the value. But once the jury returns the verdict, it's an ascertainable amount, and district courts routinely award prejudgment interest.
There are two different kinds, Your Honor, of prejudgment interest. The state is seeking the kind that is of the higher rate that would require a readily ascertainable amount at the time of the wrongful conduct. And then there is statutory prejudgment interest, which is awarded, which I think what Your Honor is talking about. Statutory prejudgment interest here is not appropriate because there is no evidence in the record, nor did the state put on any evidence, that these students had more than a $15,000 claim. And prejudgment interest is not appropriate if the claim is not greater than $15,000.
Any individual student. Okay.
There's nothing further, Your Honor. The district court's decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I'd like to go back to 56.19, and I'd like to read this into the record here, Your Honor. It says, if a person has violated this chapter by not obtaining a license when required to make loans subject to this chapter, the loan is void, and the debtor is not obligated to pay any amounts owing. The debtor may recover from such persons all amounts paid. That's what it says. We have cited to numerous cases that talk about the consequence of having a voided loan. And the consequence of having a voided loan is it didn't exist. And as a result, under various cases of this court, including the Midland case that we've cited to, it says, as a matter of law, the debtors are entitled to the return of both principal and interest. In terms of this particular statute, and that was one of our alternative arguments under the common law, that the students, because the loans are now void, are entitled to principal and interest. But as well, under 56.19, the statute really doesn't make any sense if you read it the way opposing counsel is reading it. It says, again, that the debtor may recover from such persons all amounts paid. So in other words, if the debtor sues, they can recover the money. And that is precisely what the Sunday case said. And the Sunday case, I submit to you, is reasoned very well. It makes great sense. It's consistent with the common law as well. It's also consistent with the Rimel case, which allows, again, this would be our third alternative argument. Counsel references parens patriae. The Rimel case actually allows the Attorney General, based upon the Attorney General's parens patriae authority, to also enforce the law, whether it be common law or whether it be statutory law. In that case, it dealt with club contracts, and the court, the Minnesota Supreme Court, found that that the Attorney General could obtain relief just based on the parent's authority. It doesn't have to be a statutory authorization as well. In terms of 8.31, I really encourage the court to look at the entirety of Section 8.31. The statute, again, starts out in Subdivision 1 saying that the Attorney General has the authority to enforce any of the statutes referred to in Subdivision 1, whether it be specifically referred to by citation or whether it be generally referred to as a law that deals with commerce and trade.
How do you respond to opposing counsel's interpretation of Subdivision 3 then?
Yeah.
Where under injunctive relief, the subheading, it says, laws referred to in Subdivision 1 specifically and generally, but then under the 3A, the private remedies just refers to the laws referred to in Subdivision 1.
Yeah, and thank you for that question, Your Honor. If you look at, I'm going to start with Subdivision 2 to put all this in context, Your Honor. If you look at Subdivision 2, it actually defines what laws referred to in Subdivision 1 means, and it says that it refers to the law specifically mentioned in Subdivision 1 or any other laws respecting unfair, discriminatory, or other unlawful practices in business, commerce, or trade, which we have referred to as the laws that are both specifically referenced in Subdivision 1 and those that are generally referenced in Subdivision 1. So Subdivision 2 already instructs that 8.31 applies to both laws that are specifically referenced in Subdivision 1 and laws that are generally referenced in Subdivision 1. And then when you get to Subdivision 3, Your Honor, and your question, all Subdivision 3 does is reiterates the same point. Just like Subdivision 2 says, Subdivision 1 applies to both types of laws, specifically and generally, that's precisely what Subdivision 3 says. And we have numerous alternative arguments why, based upon basic principles of statutory interpretation and construction, these arguments make no sense. The Attorney General has the authority to enforce all of the laws that are set forth in Subdivision 1. And we have also argued in the alternative that if you look at the last sentence of Subdivision 3A, it says anytime the Attorney General can bring an action under 8.31, that it can seek all the remedies referred to in 3A, which would include damages and costs and fees and that kind of thing. It's again, all that's referred to in Subdivision 3A. In this case, the other side, as well as the district court, admit that the Attorney General can bring an action for injunctive relief under Subdivision 3. So the plain language of Subdivision 3A allows the Attorney General to seek all the other remedies in 3A as an alternative argument. Now, again, based upon what I just said, the statute properly interpreted allows the Attorney General to seek all the remedies that are set forth in Subdivision 3A with respect to any laws that are referred to either specifically or generally in Subdivision 1. We've briefed up numerous alternative arguments. The district court's decision really doesn't make any sense in the context of all of the subdivisions of the statute. I see my time's up. Thank you very much.
And we appreciate, counsel, that this matter has been well briefed, now thoroughly argued. To the extent that certain alternatives were raised in the briefs, we're well aware of them and we'll consider them in making our decision. So this matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame, and we thank counsel for all of your efforts in regard to this case.